Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is our paranormal afterlife, and I'm your host Simon Bowne. In this extra episode, I'm talking to Patricia Sutcliffe about her book, Beyond the Mortal Coil: Death is Not the End, It is the Beginning. Patricia is a retired university lecturer and a seasoned human behaviourist whose passions include both writing and chess. Hi Pat, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Hello Simon, thank you for inviting me, it's an absolute honour.
We're going to talk about your book. It's called Beyond the Mortal Coil: Death is Not the End, It is the Beginning. What brought you to this point where you wanted to write this book?
Interestingly, I've wanted to write this book for a long time. But I wait for things to come to me, which may seem strange, but based on what I'm writing about, it isn't. And because I'm also a ghostwriter, every time I've sat down to sort of start and put things together, someone's come along and commissioned another ghost book. So it's sort of kept starting and stopping. But then I sat down and thought, no, I have to do this. I just had a need to do this. And one of the main reasons being, a lot of people talk about supernatural experience, metaphysical experience, whatever we want to call it. And people have asked me, because of the way that I think, people have asked me, what's a good book, Pat, that I should read to find out about these things? Because so many people have had different experiences which they cannot account for in terms of normal life. And I realised I couldn't direct them to any one book that covered it all. You know, they could get books on near-death experience, they could get thousands of books on OBEs, they could get books on paranormal phenomena, but not one that actually looked at each section. And in a way that I didn't want this to be an academic book. I wanted this to be a book where, yes, there are references in it, but I wanted it to be a book that people could read, understand quite clearly, and get just a feeling for each area that I've covered, certainly, which is a lot, of what we mean by spirituality, paranormal activity, having experiences beyond this world. And I wanted to do it not with any definitive outcome, but with them and asking them to have an open mind, read it. I am not drawing you to any conclusion. You will make your own conclusions. What I am doing is I'm trying to give you a good introduction to all of these areas. And that was my main interest and main reason for doing that.
And when you say ghostwriter and writing your ghost books, you don't mean you're writing books about ghosts.
That's a good point. No, I don't mean writing books about ghosts. For some reason, police officers are drawn to me. And I believe people are drawn to you, of course. So I've written an awful lot of books where they come to me. I basically talk to them, put their book together, put a schedule together, write their biographies, if you like. And then it's published, and then it goes from that moment on, it's theirs. They're always the author of it. And I love what I do. And two of those books have been bestsellers, which is excellent. So I love what I do there, but I also do other things. So I also teach, if I'm honest, Simon, I teach guided meditation, of which I'll be doing, in fact, this afternoon later on. And, you know, I counsel people and look at people who've had traumas. So I do an awful lot of combination of things. But in everything I do, there's a spiritual element to it.
So what sort of experiences have you had yourself?
The first one, which actually is noted in the book, I was only a young girl and I was at my parents' house then. And what happened was I'd come to bed on the evening and my mother and my sister were downstairs singing the song Sailor. My dad used to be a sailor. So singing the song Sailor, clear as a bell. I came upstairs, will say, a little bit envious because they had a very close relationship. came upstairs, got into bed, fell asleep. A while later, I can't tell you precisely how many hours. I was too young. I didn't have watches and things in my days, so can't tell you how many hours had passed. But anyway, but I woke up and they were still singing this same song. So I thought, it can't be, because I'd heard my sister come to bed. We all shared one room. We're a big family. And I heard my sister come to bed and I looked over at the bed where she slept. And yes, there she was. And I got out of bed and I walked down the corridor to my mum and dad's room. And I looked in there. My mum was in bed. Yet I could hear that song. It was as plain as day. And at that time, I wasn't frightened. I was more bewildered. I didn't know what was happening. I'd never had anything like that before. But, and even to this day, I can see myself stood at the top of the stairs listening to that song. But it was many, many years later when I was studying psychology and I came across what's known as echoic memory. And apparently that's where someone retains something in their memory as an echo and it will play back. If it was that good, I really do not know. And to this day, I can't say I think it was that, because to me, it was something that I'd never experienced, haven't experienced since, although I've experienced many other things. But it was something which awoke in me a need to know. And from that time onwards, and I was quite young. I don't know, 11, 12. I was quite young. But from that time onwards, I have always been different, felt different. And I've always looked upon things in a different way. So I don't look upon things as we're here, we have this human body, we die, that's it. I've never looked like that. I see this human body as just what it is. It's something we've borrowed. And it's something that we use upon this earth for every reason we want to consider we're on this earth. But definitely because of that first experience, I know this is not the be all and end all. This is not it.
If we could talk about different subjects in the book.
Yeah.
First start off with near-death experiences.
Mm.
Do you feel these are a really good evidence that consciousness survives?
If you couple that now with the evidence that's coming out through looking at things like quantum physics, then there's most definitely becoming more and more evidence about things happen. You know, we used to call it the spirit, the soul, but certainly energy moves on. So when I look at near-death experience, you have to be realistic. This is not something new. It may have only arisen in the 60s as far as we're concerned and be called near-death experience from the 60s. But the real reality is, if you go back in ancient times, as far back as you want, you've seen people who have had near-death experiences, not described as that. People in ancient cultures, people in Indian culture in particular, and I mean, you know, Indians themselves have had many, many tribes where they have had near-death experiences. They induce these things from a variety of things. But when we look at near-death experience today, and we've got thousands and thousands and thousands of cases, and they all bring about certain things which are the same. So if you were looking at scientific proof, we would go out and we would research something and we would take the information from a host of people, host of individuals, and we would be looking for commonalities. And then we would say, there you are, that's proof that this can happen. Why don't we do that when we're talking near-death experience? And there's millions. You can go on websites all over the place because the internet has exploded these type of things. So you can go on websites all over. You can go to various specific areas like Endove that looks at near-death experience. And when you look at the commonalities, I think that is what links it to being able to say there has to be something in it. No, can you say that? Absolutely. No, I can't. But I can say that I don't see a reason why we persistently dismiss something because it's not concrete. And near-death experience changes lives. And you can take people like Eben Alexander, for example. This was a neurosurgeon that I'm positive you know about. He was one of the, in fact, his first book I read, but one of the first people that was in the scientific world who actually said, no, this happened to me. It changed his beliefs because before that, it's pure science. It changed his beliefs and now he lectures all over the world on near-death experience. So are we going to say that he's not correct? Or are we going to say you can't prove that scientifically, what you're saying happened, but you can prove his brain was dead at the time? So, you know, you've got to be realistic. And it's time that people opened their hearts and minds and stopped what we've been indoctrinated with, needing proof for everything that happens.
So is there one near-death experience you think is really good evidence where something happens, like maybe they watched what happened while their body was dead and when they were revived, they could say, hey, I saw you do that thing?
Well, there's many accounts, aren't there? Many accounts where people have undergone operations. They've been clinically dead, yet they've, I mean, out-of-body experiences as well, of course, we're talking about, and where they can describe exact what they've seen and they can say what people were saying, even though their eyes are closed. So I can't give you a specific, I'd have to look at it, but their eyes have been closed and taped as they are during that type of operation. But I think one that I would hang on, it's not actually in the book, but it's something that I researched a long, long time ago. And it was where someone actually talked about not just looking down upon things and seeing what was happening in the room, but actually spoke about going out of the room, going down a corridor, going into a room that was high up in the building and actually looking out of a window and seeing a pair of trainers that were actually on the window ledge. Now, that couldn't possibly be seen from anyone standing at a normal visionary level down at earth level, if you like. And they all said, no, that's impossible. It couldn't get there anyway. And when they went to look and checked, it was. How did that person know? So there are things like that which are slightly out of the normal range. But, you know, the normal things such as seeing bright lights, going through tunnels, seeing past relatives, seeing people that they have never seen in real life but know are relatives, meeting spiritual beings, all of those things are so consistent, and it's not consistent amongst 12, 20, 30 people. It's consistent amongst thousands of people all over the world with different religious beliefs, different cultural backgrounds. How can we say that these things don't happen?
And these NDEs have such powerful effect on people. Like with Eben Alexander, he changed from being materialist to believing in all this stuff. Is there one particular aspect of the near-death experience that you think really changes people? Because I think the life review can have such an impact.
I think that life reviews aren't as common as some of the other aspects of near-death experience. Having said that, I think that we are traditionally, through religion, and I don't equate religion to spirituality, but we are conditioned to think that if we do bad things will happen. And people talk about, you wait, you know, once you've died, you're going to have to face this and all of the rest of it. So I don't think that's so much the thing that's going to change. I think what is the big change? It's not the life experience looking back on your life. It's looking, and this is another part of this experience, the consequences of the actions that you took and you actually being able to empathise with people that you've affected. That's what changes people.
So in your book, we talk about life after death, and that would for some people mean it's a soul, it's a spirit. How do you define what it is of us that would continue?
My I mean, if I to explain that, to answer that, I'm going to have to say my own particular thoughts on this. To me, we are all part of the universe. To me, consciousness belongs in the universe. It's not something in the mind, which is why it's remained the hard question, because nobody can find it and where it roots from. And that, again, is because scientific methodology can't cover everything. So to me, we all belong to the universe. We come from the universe. We return to the universe. And it's the pure energy, the consciousness within us that returns to the universe. I have a very firm, I say affirmations every single day. And one of my affirmations is to thank, if we call God, we can say what we want. But to me, God is the omnipresent. God is the universe, the creator. God is within each of us, without Buddhism tradition or like because of this. But the universe guides, protects us and shows us unconditional love. But we are so far removed from understanding those things that we continue with wars, fighting, one-upmanship and all of the rest that goes on. But to me, when you have a near-death experience, and I've not had one, so I can't speak specifically, but I think you see that side, you see the connectedness between us as human beings in human form and the spiritual side of what we are, and whether we call that energy, whether we call that consciousness. But that, to me, is why these things are so important to continue the study of.
So I think there's a case in your book, is it Nurse Shannon, with John's near-death experience?
If I remember correctly, that was where she was present in the operating theatre when he was basically died. He recovered, she went home, he recovered. She was on night shift at the time. He was put back into his ward. Yet when she next went into his ward, he actually told her that he knew her. She said who she was because she had no idea he knew she was present. He actually said to her, I know you because I saw you in the operating theatre and could relate to her exactly what she was doing. And that changed her. That, again, is the connectiveness between people, that one can influence another person and, you know, bring about a change because of that. And she just, he knew he'd seen her. And there was no way he could have done that had he have not had some experience that was what we call out of the norm.
You talk about children's near-death experiences. Yeah. Do you find that they're different to adults?
I think in the way that they explain them, they're different. They have to be because of language issues. But I don't think they're different in that children will talk about, I saw grandma, or I saw a shining light. I saw, if they've been brought up religiously in Christianity, I saw Jesus. So I don't think they're different in that way. In terms of changing a child, I don't think there's been enough research yet to actually say, how do children change? Because children tend to forget things because adults have this idea of, I can give you a classic example of this soon. Adults have this thing about, let's not talk about it now, because they don't want them to look to be different to any other child. But where children are concerned, there is a beautiful, and it is beautiful, there's a... It's on YouTube, and there is a thing where a young boy who is seriously ill and is talking to his dad and to Jesus, as he calls him. And just in the way he's talking, you know that is not someone prompting that child. That's that child. And he's saying things like, you know, Daddy, you're so beautiful. You look so beautiful. You cry when you actually watch it. So I think children probably have experiences which are more intense than what an adult does, but less reported because, again, of language barriers with children. And as I say, people want people to be normal, especially their child. They don't want them to stand out.
Yeah, I always wonder if children report seeing religious figures, because I wonder if adults see them because it's kind of indoctrinated into them.
You're right. But children do, because think about indoctrination, religious indoctrination. It starts when you're very young. You know, it starts in school. It starts amongst your peer groups. You go to assemblies. You know, mum and dad, if they're religious, they might take you to a church, a synagogue, wherever, whatever religion you follow in. So it is indoctrinated very young. My mum, for example, was an Irish Catholic. So I was very much indoctrinated into the Catholic religion. So, you know, I know how you, even now, I'm reluctant not to say the word God when describing something. Even though I don't see God as a figure, I do not see God as Adam being in his image, anything like that. But, you know, it's so ingrained in you. And that's why you must be careful about recognising what you're being told that's actually factual and what you're being told that's based on beliefs. So you have to be very careful. But, you know, many, many experiences that people have where they can't explain ghosts, it's a typical one, they can't explain. But when I wrote this book, I started to ask people, you know, is there anything at all? The number of people who came to me, and I actually thought, oh, they'll be saying, oh, another crank that's going to write another. No, absolutely not. They came to me. In fact, this morning, I was actually at a chess club, and this morning a woman came to me and said, you didn't ask me and get my story. I'd forgotten during the research, I'll be honest. She said, I did offer you it. Are you writing another one? Do you want my story? You know, and everywhere you go, it's not that you're searching for these people. They'll come to you. And that's because now, and more so than ever before, we are beginning to talk openly about this type of thing. And we are beginning to say, look, people need to start listening. People need to get away from this. If we can't prove it, it can't exist, because that's not true. And once people start to come forward, then it's a knock-on effect. More and more people come forward, which is why now there's a plethora of books on supernatural experiences. The same with, you know, films, lots of films about supernatural. There are podcasts, there are documentaries all over the place, which you would never have seen just 10 years ago. So that tells you that it's becoming more into the fore, and that's how it should be.
You have a chapter called Do Guardian Angels Guide Us?
Yeah.
But how do you define what an angel is?
Okay, if and I know you've read the book, there are different types that we describe. Now, when I say this, let me be very clear. I am only saying my thoughts. I am not able to say to you or anybody else, yes, we have earth angels and we have guardian angels. But for other people who've looked at this, there is a differentiation. So earth angels are perceived as those people, and it's you would know this with reincarnation, who come back onto this earth and actually come back, and they're doing things which are, they're always drawn towards helping people. They're drawn towards occupations such as doctors, nurses. They are there for people in trouble. People tend to be drawn to them and go to them and take advice and listen to what they're saying, and they lead their lives in that way. And then we say that that's an earth angel. But guardian angels aren't angels you're going to see. They are, let me give you an example, little girl, she would be eight. Family moved into a new house, a very large house. She, for once, had her own bedroom. She's in bed that night. She felt the clothes being pulled away from her body. She was only young. It scared her, obviously. She pulled them back. She thought it was her sister doing it. And when she looked around, there was no one there, but she felt a presence. Now, you might say, well, why could that be? Or even think about that as a guardian angel. The presence she felt was not threatening. She had no fear whatsoever, and actually just simply said, go away, I am frightened. Disappeared, told her mum dismissed it, you're in a dream. Sister dismissed it as stupid. Then they found out that a woman who'd sold the house to them, her mum had died in that same bedroom. And that child turned around and said, I knew she was coming back just to check who was now in her room and tell me it was okay. Now, again, children are very perceptive to things. And children will see and sense things until it's knocked out of them. Children will see and sense things more than ever we would. And that little girl just knew that that was someone coming to look after her, to basically see she was okay. Now, that's where I'd call a guardian angel. We also see accounts where people have had road accidents and they've been in the wilderness, they've been frightened, they've been near death's doors, and they've felt a presence by the side of them. And when they've felt that presence, they've suddenly felt calm again and been okay, and that presence has remained with them until help's come, and then it disappears. There's the very famous one about the battlefield at Mons, where soldiers, grossly outnumbered, fighting as usual each side, and the soldiers which were outnumbered actually spoke about seeing angels all around them that gave them the strength to move forward. Now, that's ardent war veterans, yet their individual accounts all came up with the same thing. And yes, lots of people died, but lots didn't, because they had that faith about them. Even people who were totally atheists, agnostics, they had that faith and belief about them, the guardian angels were there looking after them and telling them, you're going to be okay. So do we keep dismissing it? I don't think so.
And what about other angels like Gabriel or Michael, like the archangels? What do you view of them?
That's an interesting one, because you're speaking now about biblical angels. Being very careful what I'm saying, but I think religion is very good for those people who need religion. I think that in some instances, and it depends, remember, which religion you're talking about, but in some instances, we get the stories from the Bible, the Quran, from a variety of sources, and we're introduced to these types of things like Gabriel, all sorts of things like that. I personally have a firm belief that we are guided, and we can call that guardian angels. I have a firm belief that we are loved. Do I have a firm belief that there are specific angels doing specific things? Probably not.
Another thing in your book I noticed is you talk about not long after your father and brother died that each one of them visited you.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's something that I hold very dear to me. I'm not a person who readily accepts things. I am open-minded, let me say that. When my father passed, I was very close to my father. Still am. My father was my hero and always will be. He was my angel. I was laid in bed, and my father, as clear as if he was standing now before me, was stood at the side of my bed. His words were, Pat Love. Always used to call me Pat Love. I looked up and I said, Dad, what do you want? I'm tired. And he went, sorry, love, that was it. And I sat bolt upright and I thought, why did I say that? Why was I tired? But maybe, and you can dismiss this and say, ah, oh, well, you might have been in a dream state. You might have just been in REM sleep, whatever you want to say, but it was so clear. Normal dreams are not that clear. And the word in everything, but he was stood there. And I know that was my dad coming to say, I am okay, love. Everything's going to be fine. Not long after, because I lost three close members of my family within a very short space of time. My family was decimated. Not long afterwards, my brother passed away. Now, my brother was 10 years younger than I was, and he passed away of lung cancer literally 4 months to the day of diagnosis, and he passed. When he passed, it was sudden. So we expected he would live longer than he did. And it was sudden. And again, it was at night time. I'd just got into bed this time. And I was just starting to meditate, because I do. But I was just starting to settle down. And my brother hovered right up above me, looked down on me, big smile on his face, as he would have had. Again, it was so real and so physical that I could almost touch him. Made some comments, which I'm not repeating, made some comments, totally made sense to me, and that was it. And nobody will ever convince me that those two things did not happen. Simple as that. And that is the same. The other thing about all of these people who have near-death experiences, have premonitions, see different things, everyone will turn and say to you, that happened. Their belief in the occurrence is so strong that they will say that happened, and they don't mind if they're ridiculed. They will still not change, and they don't change the way they describe it either.
Have you ever wondered what happens after we die? In my new book, Verified Near-Death Experiences, Proof of an Afterlife, I share 30 incredible stories of people who were clinically dead, some with no heartbeat, no brain activity, yet returned with knowledge that was later verified. These accounts challenge everything we think we know about consciousness and the afterlife. It's available now as an ebook, paperback, and audiobook on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other good bookshops. Again, it's called Verified Near-Death Experiences, Proof of an Afterlife. And I hope you check it out. Do you think that you're in the right mind space to pick up on them visiting you? Like, if they'd done it during the day, you wouldn't have been able to perceive them. It's because your brain was in the right theta waves or something, and it's more like you're closer to the way a medium would get themselves in that space.
I absolutely agree with that, Simon. You come down through beta waves, alpha waves, each all the way down, as you know, if you do meditation. And yes, it's a relaxed state, but I think it's also a state where you can think, because in our everyday lives we have so much stimuli that's flowing back and forth into our brains, into everywhere else. We never actually stop to think. We don't stop to be silent. So I think what we're talking about here is only at that time are you silent. Now, that is why lots of people will say, oh, well, you were dreaming, you were in a dream state, this, that, so on and so on. Maybe that's right. But to me, no. I saw what I saw. And I heard what I heard. And I was in a relaxed state, but I was not fast asleep.
Yeah, it's kind of like past life regression. When you're hypnotized, you feel that deep sense of relaxation and your brain waves go into that same kind of state. And it seems to open something up so you can access your past lives.
Absolutely. It goes into your subconscious, because we operate on our subconscious all of the time. We don't actually think about it. But when you're doing hypnosis, and certainly past life regression, which I think is a real growing world, I really do, and I'll tell you a story about that shortly. But with past life regression, yes, you're going below your natural senses. You're going deeper than your natural senses. So all of the things about your past lives would be at that deeper place. So, yes, I think you are picking up things and seeing things that you wouldn't do in normal life. To do much of this stuff, and like you do, to do much of this, you have to be in a state where you can be silent, where you can silence your mind from everything going on, and you can be taken to another place where you can think. And then you can see different things, because you are not saying, no, that's not real, must block that out, and you're not doing that. Let me give you an example of what happens with past life regression. Little boy, 5 years of age. persistently from being 3 years of age spoke about his brother. This is one of the things in my book, William. He spoke about his brother. He spoke about having to look after his brother, who was younger. He spoke about having to work in a tall block of buildings because he had to give money to the family. So, very poor family. Within 6 months, and I used to speak to this little boy and actually say, has your brother been doing anything today? Because obviously I would never turn around and say, stop it. Because, you know, to me, that little boy was looking at something that we couldn't perceive. And what happened? I don't have a little brother. Mum and Dad told me that it's silly and that I'm an only child. And how often does that happen? And that's why children, when it comes to past life regression, are often stunted within a matter of years. And people say, well, it's now because they're older and they recognise that it can't be real. And that's not the case at all. That's been put into them because, again, parents are so keen that their children are seen as normal.
Yeah, it's this thing of reincarnation. There seems to be evidence there from past life regression and children having past life memories, and some adults have them as well.
I mean, again, you know, I can talk about when my father, and I'm talking, I'm probably a teenager, I can't tell you the age. I'm very old now, we forget. But a long time ago, and my father took me to York. Now, I'm from a very poor working class family. So a trip out to York meant something. It was like you now going to the Costa del Sol somewhere. And my father took me to York and he said, we're going to find this place called the Shambles. I always remember this. And I just said, I know where it is. And I'd never been to York in my life. But I felt a real affinity the minute I got there. And I guided my father to the Shambles. I even painted it in later life because I was so enamoured with this. And my dad said, goodness, how on earth did you know it was here? I said, I don't know, Dad. I said, something just pulled me to it, and it did. And every time now I don't live too far from York, but then I did. Every time I go to York, I am drawn to the Shambles. I get a sense of real belonging when I'm walking around that particular area. And, you know, I've thought back and people have said to me, but did you read about it? Well, no, because I'm afraid we had no books in my house. We didn't read. My parents were not educated in the sense of we had lots and lots of books, certainly historical books, books about landmarks, etc., but we had no books. So I hadn't read about it, knew nothing about York, but that was a fact. And to this day, I love walking down that street. I'm also drawn to the Victorian era and have a keen sense. And many a time when I'm meditating, I actually can see myself in Victorian dress and I go back to that era. So, you know, I'm not a stupid person. I'm quite educated now. Am I going to say to myself, oh, well, it's wishful thinking. It's what you wish would have been and so on. No, I'm not.
Yeah, that's something that I talk about with clients, that when you go into a past life regression, you get into this past life and it's all coming up in your imagination. So you can feel like you're making it up as you go along. But the lives that come through are so unexpected and unpredictable, it's the last thing that you'd make up.
You wouldn't know a lot of the details. This is particularly true with children. They wouldn't be able to describe clothing, even describe a different way of speaking, a different accent and so on. They wouldn't be able to do that. But, you know, on another occurrence, I can't say I've had thousands, but I've had lots. On another occurrence, I actually was back in Jacobean times and I have a birthmark right at the front of my neck. And I would tell anybody it's where someone put a knife through my neck. And that's how I died in that life. Because I was actually, and this was through past life regression, I was actually a magistrate. It wasn't called a magistrate then, but I was a justice of the peace, and it was someone that I'd obviously sent to prison, whatever, who came up behind me and stabbed me. And, you know, I know the clothing I was wearing, the long cloak, the long gown, the queer-shaped hat, and I can tell you all of that. And then afterwards I've thought, now, did you imagine that, or is that something? But I have never read about Jacobean periods. Never. So, you know, where does it come from? Maybe I've watched a film and seen something like that. But why that particular thing? Because that's the other question. On the millions and millions of input we have into our brain through film, through media, why is it a specific time and a specific thing? If that can be explained, fine.
You talk about Jenny Cockle in your book, and she's quite remarkable in her memories, isn't she?
That was brilliant, because where she was concerned, she believed that she'd been in Ireland. She believed that, I think it was six children. It was a lot of children. It might have been more. Can't remember now, but she talked about this over and over, and she was given an opportunity to actually go to the place. She'd named the place. She went back to the place and actually found, if you like, relatives of the woman that she believed she was. And it was the offspring of the children. And they confirmed all of the things she was saying. Now, you know, are you telling me then that you go out and you collaborate with people that you don't know to say this, say that? Rubbish. Of course you don't. So, you know, that is almost one that you can say that was proven, if you want to look at it that way. But that was a fantastic story. There was actually, I read the book, but I also saw the film on TV. And it's fascinating to watch. I don't know if you've watched it, Simon, but it's certainly well worth watching. It was a brilliant story.
Yeah, I've got the book, and I did interview her three or four years ago. And it's also that thing that she still remembers it, even though she's an adult, because children forget their past life memories when they get to 7, 8, 9 years old.
Only when they're encouraged to forget. That's where, again, to me, it's a misconception, because it's like with William, who now says, no, and I never had a little brother, right? Because he's been encouraged and told, you're an only child, you don't have a brother, you sound silly. So a lot of the time, children, when they get to 7, 8 years of age, they're starting into primary school. So if you're talking about these things with other children, think about it, you know, that haven't had such experiences, very quickly will you start to be ridiculed. So what you're going to do, you want to fit in with the norm. You want to fit in with other children. And in order to do that, you become like them. It's why we copy so many things, same shoes. Say, I want that coat, he's got that coat, and so on and so on. So I don't think it's necessarily that they forget at a certain age. I think they are encouraged through whatever means to forget at a certain age and become what's perceived as normal.
Another note I've made from something in your book is the 1960s Alice in Castleford.
Oh, goodness, yeah. That was brilliant. And actually, I do know that was so real. What happened was she moved into a flat, and it was there's a block of flats, because I actually went down and I did look. There's a block of flats, and there was a shop underneath called Pennington's, and it was a shop that sold rifles, knives. You wouldn't see it today, but rifles, knives and all sorts. And right in the middle of this row of shops was a staircase. You went up the staircase, and then there were flats. I can't remember if there were 4 or 3. I can't remember. She moved into one of those flats. And Alice, if you meet her and speak to her, is not a girl that is religious. She's not a girl that would actually, you know, openly say that she'd had experiences. Far from it. She's one of these very down-to-earth, get-on-with-it-in-life type of people. And when she was telling me this, what she said was, the first time she said it was the, I think it was the light shades initially that started swaying. And then I don't know, she said she went to a window because she thought there must be a window open. It's a draft. There wasn't. And then I don't know if it was the curtains, but things started moving, all sorts of things. Yet again, she didn't feel fear. And she's a humorous person. She said, I thought, if this is a ghost, I'm going to address him. So she called him Fred. that was, but the way she tells you that, I called him Fred. And she used to have conversations with Fred. And then after a while, she started to tell friends and different people. And of course, they laughed. I know it's just Alice being silly, and as people do. And they do it very often out of embarrassment because they don't know what to say. So they laughed. Anyway, after a period of time, she got opportunity to move to another flat within the same building. And as she moves out, a family move in. So not knowing about, you know, whether she should say, not say, she moves out. And then the other family are called Jonte and Phyllis, and they have three children. The children experienced nothing. Jonte and Phyllis experienced a lot more and a lot stronger goings on than Alice had. And I think that perhaps is a way in which you approach it. Alice was very laissez-faire. Okay, Fred, you want to be there, be there. You know, it's a sort of a dismissal thing, but knowing and feeling someone was there. They were more of a frightening, you know, what's happening. And they tell about an occurrence where brother and sister-in-law stayed at the flat one night. Sister-in-law goes up to bed because she tired, I suppose. Few short time later, she felt what she thought was her husband get into bed with her. And when she turned around, there was no one there. It wasn't her husband. And she screamed, jumped out the bed. And that's when Phyllis and Jonte started openly to say, well, look, we should have told you that things happen because someone shakes our bed and things happen. And then it sort of came round to where Jonte was once in the house, in the flat alone. Everybody was out and he felt someone flick him across the backside with what he perceived to be a towel. Turned around, nobody there. He said, and I know there was nobody in that flat but me, he said, but I know I felt that so strongly, he said, it even hurt. And, you know, just the way you can tell when someone's telling you something, if they're trying to fabricate something, just by watching body language, etc. And there was no doubt these were not fabricating, and actually said they were so glad when they left the flat. What happened to it then, I don't know. But that was two. The reason that was important is in the book, that was two different sets of people experiencing the same phenomena and both people talking about it. So, you know, I mean, you can say, well, yeah, you've said that it's haunted, but no one else has seen that. This was a different case. It's where two sets of people knew and saw the same thing, even in different ways, if that makes sense to you.
You seem to like finding where there's evidence like that, that there's something skeptics could argue against it, but then you can point stuff out that argues back against them.
I don't think I do it, Simon, to be able to argue against them, because quite frankly, if people are so close-minded that they can't accept that something else may be different to what they believe, then that's their issue. So I don't have to prove it. But I mean, for my own thing, when I'm doing research and actually going and talking to people, of course, I'm going to these places. Yeah, if I can see it and I think, well, that place exists, it's there. So, you know, it's like anything else. There is a big thing about people saying, what proof do you have? My answer immediately is, what proof do you have that it's not there? No scientific proof. So what proof is there that the things that people believe and see? And if you believe, as I do, in the universe, because this all comes out of the universe, different ways of showing us that more exists, if all of this comes out of the universe and you believe in the universe. If you don't, why are we so intrigued now by quantum physics, but also by the universe? Why do we want to explore so much about the universe if we think that we get to a certain age and we've gone? Why? And why do people on the deathbeds reach their arms up? And any nurse that's been involved in, you know, end-of-life care will state this about people lifting their hands up as if they're looking at something, talking to something. My mum, another classic, when she was passing away, spoke to my grandma and granddad, who'd been long since gone, who she pointed out to in a corner. So, you know, is this all illusion? I mean, we're now saying our lives are illusion, but is this all illusion? Or can we be open-minded enough to say that there is a lot more to what we are, who we are, and to what our particular energy is than we are actually willing to say?
Yeah, and this thing with people having these like deathbed visions,
yeah,
it may be because they're getting closer to death, so something's opening up. Like they talk about the veil. Maybe it's becoming thinner for them because they're so much closer to death.
Absolutely agree with you 1,000%, because you're at a point where nothing matters anymore in terms of earthly things. You know, you're not thinking, what am I doing tomorrow? Will they survive? Will this, will that? You are thinking purely of things that's happening to you and how you're feeling. And I think you are really right in that, you know, a veil sort of removes itself. And the other thing, I mean, if you read what it says at the end of the book on the last page, and I actually say, and I quote, beyond the mortal coil, we do not end, we unfold, stepping into the greater life of what we've always been. So is it that people suddenly start to realise, wow, this is more than ever I perceived, that I'm actually... something's happening that I can't probably understand or probably verbalise, but they can see it, they can sense it, and what a wonderful thing.
And there's also something in your book, you talk about the hard problem of science to do with consciousness. What's the hard problem?
The hard problem is because scientists, as well you know, neurosurgeons, all of those areas of science, they are so determined to associate everything that happens with the brain. And that's what our problem is. Yet they know we are conscious. And we are conscious because we know that we are we. So that's why we are conscious. Now, what they can't find out is, where does consciousness lie in the brain? What part of the brain actually affects it? So therefore, they call it the hard problem. And that's simply because they've never looked beyond the brain. Now, again, I'll refer to quantum physics, and I'm not a scientist. I don't know a vast amount about this, but it's something I'm certainly now getting very interested in and researching. With quantum physics, there is a strong indication that consciousness does not exist within the brain. It exists outside of the brain and we draw from it. Now, wouldn't that make more sense?
There's just those materialists and atheists, and sometimes it seems like they've got their fingers in their ears and they're just saying, I can't hear you, I can't hear you.
Smack on. Well, think about it. If you're a scientist and you've lived by a certain set of rules, and we all live by rules of society, but it's not just society, is it? We live by rules of a family, rules of a household, rules of a school, goes on and on and on. So if they live by a set of rules where proof is everything, what would it look like if they started stepping out of that, like your Raymond Moody's of this world, if they started stepping out of that and saying, I think there's more to it? They would be discredited. Their reputations wouldn't be what they are now. And I think it's fear in a lot of this that stop people moving forward and looking at different areas. One of the books I'm reading now, and I'm desperately, as I'm saying it to you, it's in my bedroom, so I can't tell you the name of it, but it's a guy, and he works at what's called Leeds Beckett University. It used to be the old technical type school, and he writes books and is very much into this, and he's stepping out of his realm, if you like, and he's stepping into another realm, and he's saying, listen, let's take notice of this and let's step up to the mark and stop being so bogged down by what we can prove and not prove. And let's just say we don't know, and therefore, if we don't know, we can't say it doesn't exist either.
There's another thing you talk about in the book of distressing near-death experiences, where people have these kind of hellish things happen.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you think some people get those experiences and others get wonderful experiences?
Mm. I think that's a really, really interesting question. And I think it's something that certainly needs to be explored. But having said that, what comes out of that, and I can't say why some people have one type, some people have another. I can say that the prevalence is for the very good experience. But even those who have bad experiences still change, and they still undergo a massive transformation for the better. So that should say something. Why it happens, I don't know. I don't know the backgrounds enough. But if I've been indoctrinated to believe in I'll go to hell if I'm bad, and I'll go to heaven if I'm good, perhaps that my thoughts on my deathbed are that I wasn't the good person I ought to be, and perhaps that influences it. I don't know.
Yeah, I wonder if with near-death experiences, whoever decides what your experience is going to be, maybe it's tailored for you. Maybe it's spirit guides or angels, and they'll look at one person and they know exactly what they need, and this other person, that's exactly what they need.
I think that's a really profound thing to say, Simon. And I think, you know, I wouldn't disagree with any of that, but a lot of people coming back from near-death experiences do actually say that they are allowed to choose to come back, and they are allowed to choose when they pass on which life they are coming back to. So there's things like this, same with past life regression, that they are choosing the life, and it's all about learning. And the more we can learn, but not learning about how to succeed, how to get money, how to build an empire, learning about compassion, learning about loving fellow human beings, learning about connectedness. And perhaps it is that we need to learn lessons, and some of the lessons are still being learned as you pass over.
Is there something that you would say this is the best evidence that consciousness continues? One particular case or one of these things we've been talking about today?
I wouldn't say there's a particular case, because it depends how we look at consciousness. And if we see consciousness as everything around us, everything there is, everything that ever was and everything that ever will be, then all I can say is that whilst there's no particular case, every case shows it. Because in its own way, we are all talking about consciousness moving on beyond, as I've put, this mortal coil. So if consciousness is all around us, there can't be one particular case. Every aspect of paranormal activity is about consciousness.
Well, it's been great talking to you.
Thank you.
The book's called Beyond the Mortal Coil. Death is not the end, it is the beginning. And where can people get that?
They can buy that book. It's now out on Amazon. They can either buy it as an ebook, or they can buy it, obviously, as a paper copy, which I tend to like. And I'm hoping they'll love the actual description on the front, because it's lovely. It's very artistic. They can buy that book there. And I'm sure that, you know, and I thank you for allowing me to talk about it, because you've actually reawakened things in me just as I'm talking to you, Simon. It's out there. And all I say is, if you're going to buy this book, do not buy it if you are not open-minded. And just to quote the final thing I will quote to you, and as I put right at the front when I finished the introduction, and where I write is right at the beginning, things are, you know, thoughts, etc., it's like a block of wood. It only becomes alive when you actually see beyond it. That's not the exact words, but I can't, as I'm flicking through my book, desperately thinking, where is it that I put that little quote?
Yeah.
But, oh, I've got it. A closed mind is like a closed book. It's nothing more than a block of wood. And if you think about the significance of those two lines, it says everything, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Do you have a website?
I do. It's the website is www.patriciasutcliffeauthor.com.
Great, great, excellent. Well, thanks again for being on the podcast.
I've loved it. Thank you, Simon. It's so nice to actually speak to someone who's same-minded that you can have an open discussion with without trying to justify yourself. So it's been brilliant, and thank you so much for inviting me.
It's been great. Thanks. And that was an interview with Patricia Sutcliffe about her book, Beyond the Mortal Coil, Death is Not the End, It is the Beginning. A great way to support this podcast is to join Patreon, where you get access to the extended episodes. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions, and you can now sign up for a 7-day free trial. And my book, titled Verified Near-Death Experiences, is out on Amazon, and you can get it on audiobook, paperback, or Kindle. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.